Chances are you have never heard of William Vogt. Yet according to author Charles C. Mann, his philosophy is one of the few that was born in the last century and is as relevant now, if not more, than when Vogt started campaigning to save the environment. William Vogt is responsible for defining the environment. Before he so perfectly gave shape to the environment as a global and interconnected system, ecological issues were deemed to be local or site-specific. Mann goes into great detail in his book, The Wizard and the Prophet, about Vogt and the development of his philosophy that says the carrying capacity of the Earth is limited. Vogt believes that the biggest threat to Mother Nature is an outbreak of humans. I invited Charles C. Mann to join me for a conversation that matters about the remarkable influence of William Vogt in shaping the modern environmental sector.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Charles Mann, welcome to Conversations That Matter. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I want to focus in on your book, The Wizard and the Prophet, but today I want to talk about the prophet, who was remarkably prescient and quite a groundbreaker, and yet, as you point out, he wasn't convinced that he was. Exactly who was William Vogt?
Well, the best way to say it is he's the sort of the intellectual father of the environmental movement. If you read books like the ones by Al Gore or, you know, any of the kind of environmental books that you see by Jared Diamond and any of those people, they all trace back to a book that he wrote in 1948 and, you know, sort of setting the terms for the way the environmental movement thinks about things and what it should do.
How did you discover him?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I was reading a couple of books about environmental issues, different environmental issues, and all of them had a footnote that said, oh yes, by the way, this traces back to this guy, William Vogt, and his book, Road to Survival, which was a bestseller in 1948, and which I had never heard of. And the final thing that cued it was when I read an article by the guy who wrote The Population Bomb, which when I was a kid came out and was a tremendously important best-selling book that really helped launch the environmental movement. And that author, Paul Ehrlich, said, oh, yeah, I started with William Vogt. And I thought, gee, I'd like to find out more about this guy.
So as you started to dig into Mr. Vogt's background, what were some of the striking characteristics about him and his, I guess, adoption of a Malthusian viewpoint and how that started to play out in the way that he started to try and move forward issues around environmental issues?
Well, he was born into a very poor family in rural Long Island, and which he loved at that time. This is before, you know, the highways came in, before the suburbs came in, and there are enormous fields and that are full of butterflies and so forth in central Long Island. And then he lost them as a child, both in the sense that they were, you know, rapidly developed while he was a teenager, and also because his mother married somebody. His father sort of ran off when he was very young, and his mother remarried to somebody who lived in the middle of the city. And he was, you know, thrust into a poor urban environment and greatly missed, you know, the experience of being outdoors. And this made him a conservationist. And then he saw suburbanization eating up the outdoors all over, you know, New England and the New York area. And that sort of primed him for the ideas that he was to develop. And it really took off when, during the Depression, he got a job as an ornithologist, even though he wasn't a trained scientist, in Peru, where he was trying to maintain seabird populations. And he came to the conclusion, essentially, that you can't tweak nature. Either, you know, nature has certain rules, they are inviolate, and if humans try to mess with them, the results are going to be catastrophic, is what Paul Ehrlich has a way of putting it. He said, nature bets last, you know, that if we don't control our actions with nature, we're really going to put ourselves into trouble. And And he didn't become so much a Malthusian as he recast Malthus for a modern era. What Malthus said was that population will outstrip food supply inevitably, right, because population grows exponentially and the food supply can only grow arithmetically. Now, Malthus sort of picked this idea out of his hat. I mean, it's sort of implying that one species, people, reproduces at an inherently faster rate than, you know, wheat or some other species. There's no reason to suppose this. What Vogt said is, no, we can feed ourselves, but the consequences of doing so will destroy the ecosystems on which we depend.
Well, William Vogt put forward the idea of carrying capacity referring to the environment,
yes,
not carrying capacity referring to ships or modes of transport. But the entire system is interconnected, and
right,
there is only so much capacity. And at some point, you're going to overload that, and then there will be a readjustment. Mother Nature will come in and force a readjustment.
Right. And that idea, you know, is all over today. You know, if you look at papers, they're always talking about the human footprint and that it surpasses what the humans, what Earth can sustain. Or they talk about planetary boundaries, meaning that there's only so much carbon dioxide or only so much soil that we can take and maintain, only so much water. And so all of these ideas stem from Vogt, with this idea that we have a finite planet with rules, you know, natural rules. And if we surpass the limits set by those rules, we're going to doom ourselves as well as the rest of the nature.
I thought that it was interesting, you know, that you point out that his biggest concern was the biggest threat to the environment was an outbreak of human beings.
And he assumed that essentially consumption per person is fixed. And that, so, you know, more people, more consumption, more environmental degradation. But it's actually a little bit more complicated than that, as we've come to see. You know, I live in Massachusetts, which has, you know, I think 7 million people in it, way more than it did, you know, 150 years ago. But the environment around me is in far better shape than it was 150 years ago. There's, you know, 2/3 of the state is covered by forest, which is pretty much what it was in 1700. You know, the rivers are clean and so forth. So the connection of population and environmental damage is much more complex than Vogt thought it was.
He didn't buy into the philosophy that prosperity would actually help to protect the environment.
No. But at the same time, you know, it's a question, because the question is, what kind of prosperity? Can richer societies decouple themselves from the environment? That's the sort of language that, that people use. And the counter-argument to Vogt is that if societies get rich enough, they can protect the environment and maintain people's standards of living. And there's a very strong argument back and forth to this day about whether that is true. And Vogt firmly took one side. I would argue that the question, you know, from what I can tell, the question is still up in the air. He might be right, but we don't know yet.
Well, it's interesting that he came to that perspective, because as he started to establish his credibility as an ornithologist through the Audubon Society, that was a society that was really supported by a bunch of upper class elites who believed that they had a responsibility to protect the environment. And so there would be that connection between prosperity and the environment, mm-hmm, and they were considered to be very much out on the right side of the, I guess, political spectrum. And this
right,
is where Vogt started, but it was that very prosperity that he railed against.
This is both the pro and con argument all wrapped up. One is, well, look at all those Park Avenue dentists. You know, they're funding the Audubon Society, which is one of the most largest and most effective environmental organizations on Earth. The other argument is those Park Society dentists are driving fancy cars and, you know, consuming lots and lots of resources.
As I read your accounting of him, and the detail in your book is extraordinary. I don't know how you managed to find all of those elements, but I was reading about after he had been out looking at the situation on Long Island, he was looking at, you know, this as being just a horrible, horrible situation. How is he going to mobilize people to get concerned about this? And because he was the editor of Bird Lore at the Audubon Society, he said, I'm going to use the power of that publication to motivate people to get behind the environment. What an extraordinary thing to be able to invent at that time when there was no model for it. And yet I think current environmentalists could say, well, there it is. There was the guidebook.
Exactly. This is part of the reason that I was fascinated by him, because he invented not only the sort of intellectual framework, we were talking about carrying capacity, so many of the tools. And that is using environmental journalism to as a tool to mobilize people to address problems. And the thing that he was talking about was mosquito control in Long Island. Long Island was beset by mosquitoes, and there are lots of suburban people who wanted to leave the unhealthy city and go out into the countryside, and they didn't like the mosquitoes, so they poisoned and ditched and diked huge areas, sprayed enormous amounts of DDT, and this had catastrophic impacts on the birds, which, of course, you know, anybody in Audubon Society is really going to care about. And this was one of the first sort of modern environmental crusades, where they were challenging both government scientists and corporations, and largely they won. And it was a kind of model for what happened, you know, all the way up to the present day.
The other thing that I found quite interesting is about him is that he did not hold back. You had no doubt about where he stood. He was rather acerbic and assertive in his pronouncements about where we were going and what needed to be done.
It's funny because in certain ways, his personality got in the way of his message. Yeah. He had a knack for insulting people and calling his opponents names. And sometimes that kind of strident language is really effective. Often it's not. And he didn't really have a good regulator for this. And in a funny way, I see the same thing in many environmental activists now. They feel beleaguered. They feel set upon. And so they really let their opponents have it, sometimes to their own detriment, in my opinion. But this, too, was another pattern that was set by vote. And some of the language in Road to Survival makes your hair curl. It's really going after people.
Like, really going after them. And as you say, this cancel culture, being virtuous, being a variety of things where you're calling out people that you don't agree with, appears to have really found its roots in Mr. Vote. And, you know, with Road to Survival, I think one of the other interesting things that I found about the publication of that book is it was instantly a huge success and embraced by the right, denounced by the left, and then ultimately denounced by everybody. And yet it still, as you point out, has become a seminal work in our relationship with the environment, and alliances across the political spectrum seems to have changed.
Yeah, it's interesting because the history of conservation isn't what most people think it is. Today, I think it's pretty fair to say that conservation is generally associated with the left, but it started with the right. And, you know, this is one of those stories that makes nobody happy because at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of wealthy people in places like New York were very concerned about the destruction of the American environment, the loss of the buffalo, and so forth. And they wanted to have essentially a pristine exterior world that they could use for their second houses and playgrounds and so forth. And that kind of went along with the same desire to have a pristine kind of people. Many of these same people who were concerned about the environment were also greatly concerned about letting the lesser orders, quote unquote, into society and outbreeding us and having and supporting things like eugenics. So, you know, they wanted to improve the environment. They wanted to improve people. And these things were completely tangled up with each other in ways that now are bewildering to read. And now that most people don't like eugenics, are sort of deeply embarrassing. And this somehow migrated to the left. And so the people who are concerned about, you know, having parks and cleaning up the waters now are now saying, wait a minute, what about the economy? Whereas the left in the early days said, wait a minute, that means jobs, and jobs mean, you know, survival for the poor. How dare you rich, out of touch elitists care about trees and plants when, you know, we care about people. And these things have migrated across from each other.
You know, you talk about the eugenics component. William Vogt, of course, if he believed that there were too many people and this was a problem, of course, would be a supporter of Planned Parenthood, which ultimately he was. And I believe it was Margaret Sanger who founded Planned Parenthood. And, mm-hmm. and there are many suggestions or documentation that point back to her as being someone who supported eugenics, saying, you know, it's we got to be careful that we don't get too many people and too many of the wrong kind of people. And I find that that's a little bit unsettling about Mr. Vogt. But, you know, he was truly committed to the idea that people were the biggest problem on the face of the earth.
It's very complicated because obviously people are the biggest problem on the face of the earth, but also they're the solution, right? You know, the problems posed by people can only be solved by people and will be, I hope, solved by people.
As you worked your way through your research for The Wizard and the Prophet and read about Mr. Vogt, did he wind up in some ways reshaping your views around our ability as a species to have appropriate carrying capacity, to use his term?
The answer is yes and no. I'm sorry to be so wishy-washy, but it was very interesting to me to sort of realize what this central idea is, this idea of carrying capacity, and realize how little research there is into what that carrying capacity might actually be. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. Soon after he wrote the book and had this big impact, the Rockefeller Foundation, which was then the biggest foundation in the world, the executive read his book and said, holy cow, should we be doing something about this? This guy mm-hmm. is saying that this is the world's biggest problem. And he handed it off to a physicist, an important physicist. And the physicist said, well, energy is what is the limiting factor, you know, of all life. And he calculated how much sunlight is hitting the earth. And he said, well, we could never use that much energy in a million years. There's no problem. And he said, yes, there is a carrying capacity, but it's so high that it's irrelevant. You know, mm-hmm. if the carrying capacity of the world is 200 billion people, then the fact that we have 7 billion people is, you know, just doesn't mean anything. What I took from that is not so much that the guy was right, but that would be really useful for us is to understand what is the actual carrying capacity of the Earth. And I think this is something we just don't really understand. The planetary boundaries people, who are a bunch of researchers in Scandinavia mainly, have been trying to ascertain this. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And they have come up with 9 different, you know, how much fresh water is there? How much carbon dioxide can we put in the air? You know, this kind of thing. And they've been trying to answer that. But it's striking that, you know, 70 years after Vogt put out this argument, we still don't know actually how much, what the limits are.
Well, we're going to be tested here in the next few decades. I just did an interview with an agrologist who said the next 30 years could be the most challenging in the history of agriculture because we're going to have to grow 10,000 years worth of food as the global population climbs to about 9.5 billion. And for the most part, we're going to do that without expanding the agricultural footprint. So how are we going to do that? Mm-hmm. I think we're really going to be pushed up against those limits.
It's very possible. You know, there's answers that the other side, which I call the people who believe in that you can solve these through science and technology if you properly apply them, and they would give you some suggestions on how we might answer this. The Vogtians, you know, the people I call prophets, would say, most of those involve draining the well too much. And that we have to, they would say that we have to reduce what we eat. We have to reduce our impacts, you know, put on our cardigan sweaters and turn down the thermostats and all those kinds of things that you hear about. And that's a fundamental argument about our future. Can we use science and technology to have things as abundant as some of us would like, or are we going to be forced to retrench? And Vogt was very firmly on the retrench side.
After reading your book and description of him, I came to understand why on the environmental sector these days there is such a resistance to genetic engineering, because genetic engineering offers the promise of greater abundance. And if so, then it's going to support larger and larger populations. And I can see that at the root of that is a reason why there would be pushback against genetically engineering foods and organisms.
Yeah, another way of putting it is when genetic engineering, you know, sort of first came out, people like Rob Fraley, the guy who ran Monsanto until recently, said this is the way of the future for agriculture. And the agriculture he meant wasn't like small family farms and, you know, friendly cows and all that, but, you know, big industrial farms. And environmental groups, by and large, consider those big farms as an insult to nature. You know, they're sort of awash in various chemicals. You know, they destroy the microbiome of the soil. They're not, you know, they're industrial monocultures, all these complaints. And so genetic engineering is presented as something to keep that going.
Well, that's the perception that they're putting forward. I've been doing an awful lot of research about farming, and especially when you get into the central part of North America, it's because of these advances that we stopped tilling the soil, and that tillage was decimating the nutritional value of soil. And so where is the balance? I don't pretend to know, but it's going to be, I'm sure, a long and vocal argument that will continue on with roots going back to Mr. Vogt. Charles, thank you very much for taking the time to join me on this conversation, and I encourage people to read your book, The Wizard and the Prophet. It is a real eye-opener, and as you point out, Mr. Vogt is the author, or the grandfather at least, of one of the leading philosophies that have survived the past century.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.